This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. New issues of Yes Magazine have hit newsstands and mailboxes all over the nation, and this spring 2024 issue is themed around connections, a deeply relevant idea at a time when more people are digitally connected than ever before, at the same time as we're still grappling with pandemic-related physical isolation. Joining me to preview this issue is Sanavi Bridham, Managing Editor at Yes Media. Welcome to the program, Sanavi.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
It's lovely to be with you. You and I work together on a daily basis, and we were part of the team that put this issue together that we're both, I know, very proud of. How did you interpret this theme of connections that set the tone for or framed how the issue then ended up transpiring and becoming a reality? What did connections mean for Yes in this issue?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We actually began conceiving of this issue thinking we were going to do a technology issue, that we were going to explore technology, communication, and as we began working together with the team, of course, you're a part, our editorial team, we realized that technology and tech overall was too big of a theme. It was too broad. There were too many different angles to explore. So we started diving in. And, you know, through conversations with our team, really realized that what we were talking about was how we use technology to communicate and to connect with other people, because that's what really we believe at Yes, and I personally believe helps fuel change, right? Connection can be a balm to the isolation that so many of us feel. And for a lot of us who are still isolated, who are working remote, like all of us, folks are immunocompromised, technology is a primary mode in which we can still feel connected to the world around us, even as we continue to isolate to keep ourselves and our loved ones safe in the midst of an ongoing pandemic. So we started diving into exploring the theme of connection more broadly, specifically through a lens of technology, both in the ways in which technology is used to connect grassroots organizers who are doing movement work, who are, you know, pushing liberation forward, but also literally in ways that we maybe take advantage or we take for granted of the ways that we connect, that we use technology to connect, the weight of our data, like what happens to all of our data in the cloud. There's a story that explores that in this issue. And then we really looked at some of the ways that, you know, in-person connection still matters, right? There's still value there. There's still, you know, community is still such a central aspect to how so many of us orient ourselves in the world. And so that's kind of what we began exploring. And you're right, I'm very proud of this issue. I think the topics that it spans really offer a unique perspective on this topic that I think you won't find anywhere else except in Yes.
So the fact that technology was to be the earlier theme still kind of shows up in this issue, because the way in which most of us these days are connected to the most people is digitally. And so let's talk about the digital technology related stories, the stories centered around social media that made it into this issue. There were some, you know, maybe more lighthearted stories, my favorite titled one, Friend or FOMO, and then two really big, deeply reported stories around the role that social media has played in movements. So tell me about these stories.
Yeah, so those are the two stories. The lead feature I edited called Social Media for the Revolution, written by Raina Sultan, and then the piece you edited, of course, Connective Liberation, written by Maria Armudian. And both of these stories look at the ways that social media historically and in the span of history, right, social media is a very recent development when we think about, you know, the whole span of human history. So Raina's piece, which is, I apologize, now I'm blanking on the name. Raina's piece, Social Media for the Revolution, really takes a broad historical look at the ways that grassroots organizers in particular have utilized social media to press progressive and liberatory causes forward. And Raina, who is the associate editor at Newsette, brought this pitch to us with a really interesting angle, essentially arguing that the through line and some of the most early adopters of social media, of digital work to connect, to pursue liberation, are actually sex workers. Who were absolutely early adopters of the internet from the early days of Craigslist. Many sex workers found that the internet offered a platform for them to engage in their work more safely, right? Whether it was, you know, by now we're talking about OnlyFans, we're talking about, you know, digital parameters in which folks can engage in various elements of sex work, to even just vetting potential clients, all of these different elements. So Raina's piece really kind of draws that thread all the way through, and of course then connects, you know, the work that sex workers have been doing around not only decriminalization but just making their work safer, and then talks about how that thread then follows through. And because sex workers and their work is so often criminalized, it provided a really fascinating point to look at the ways that society, governments, corporations continue to police this kind of organizing, this kind of connective work on the digital front, including certainly, you know, shutting down of Craigslist, Backpage. But then we see this span into real life as well. Of course, when we start to see the criminalization of abortion and of reproductive health care, where again, many folks are organizing, folks continue to organize to access reproductive health care in states where it's been restricted. Much of that organizing happens online and has to happen somewhat surreptitiously because of the aggressive policing of those, of access to those rights. And then Raina draws the through line all the way through to what we're seeing. You know, certainly she discusses Ferguson, the uprising for Black Lives, for Black Lives Matter, to Mike Brown's death, all the way through, of course, to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the massive organizing we saw in the uprisings of 2020, all the way through to today, where we are seeing Palestinians, folks in Gaza, documenting genocide in real time. And those of us who are following this are seeing this kind of devastation on our phones, on our screens, beamed into our homes. Meanwhile, we're seeing corporations like Meta, like Twitter, now called X, I'm going to continue to call it Twitter, cracking down on this kind of communication, shadow banning. Raina's piece gets into what that looks like and how that has been really weaponized and continues to silence this kind of organizing and voices. So Raina's piece really does this kind of broad historical piece, this broad historical perspective. And then Maria's piece, Connective Liberation, looks a little more at kind of how some of boots on the ground organizing has happened and how social media has supported that sort of organizing. It talks about certainly the uprising for Black Lives, also talks a lot about Occupy Wall Street, which was one of the earlier movements to really leverage digital organizing for in-person action. And that's really kind of this beautiful marriage that we're seeing that I think is clearly powerful because we are now seeing governments and corporations crack down on it. And if it weren't impactful, they wouldn't bother with that.
So then there's also this idea of maybe a little bit more lighthearted stories around how social media makes us feel and also how we end up, you know, how we have been connected. I'm specifically talking about the way in which people tend to, society gets frayed when we envy one another, which social media unfortunately encourages, but then society also mobilizes when we have ways to connect, as Yvette Dion, our executive editor, points out in her Memoriam to Black Twitter, which is a sort of obituary, if you will, to the social media platform that had played such a huge role in so many movements, not the least of which was the 2020 racial justice uprising. And so, you know, it's really interesting that this issue has examined both sides of the coin when it comes to digital technology. There is good, there is bad, right?
Absolutely, right? And that's something Yes always aims to do, right, is complicate the narrative. There, you know, very rarely in our world is any issue black and white. Yes lives in the gray. We aim to complicate that narrative and help folks understand the context and offer folks information that they need to be able to form their own opinions. I love Yvette's piece about Memoriam for Black Twitter. She really, I think, captures the incredible cultural moment that was Black Twitter. It was in some ways this organic creation, right? I don't believe that the folks who developed Twitter believed that it would become a hub for Black culture and commentary and humor, right? As well as cultural critique, right? We absolutely saw, as you mentioned, right, Twitter being pivotal to the uprisings in 2020 and preceding. Would we have known about the uprisings in Ferguson and Mike Brown's death if we hadn't seen it on Twitter? Maybe not. Maybe we would have had the police narrative that we so often see claiming that these were violent riots. But we've also seen, you know, truly Twitter and Black Twitter in particular defined culture in a way that was really unique. And I appreciate in Yvette's piece that she names that it's unknown where that will go, right? Since Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, Yvette has this great line, and I think we put it in the subhead, the deck for the piece, that, you know, Twitter was once a bastion of culture, a culture maker, and it is now more like a sundown town, right? The platform privileges alt-right white supremacist perspectives over those of folks from more historically marginalized communities. And it's really become a hostile environment. And at this point, nothing has stepped in to fill the gap. That doesn't mean that nothing will, but I appreciate Yvette for naming the value of this platform, because we do need to grieve those as well, right? Like, that's a piece of culture that perhaps we're losing.
We also had a wonderful spread in, or we have a wonderful spread in the winter issue about the price that we pay for all of the connections that we have, literally the physical price that we pay, and that is the weight of the cloud. I loved this piece. This was overseen by our colleague Brianna Draxler. Tell me about this incredible, it's our Just the Facts spread, so it's very visual.
Exactly. I love the way this came together. You're correct. It's Just the Facts. It's our infographic spread, so our story in data. And, you know, Brianna brought this idea to the team because we think about, you know, we know our data lives in the cloud, right? We pay however much I pay for, you know, my Apple iCloud storage or Google Photos storage. And we don't really think about, like, where that lives. And it turns out that data actually lives in physical data centers, right, that consume incredible amounts of natural resources, energy, not to mention the rare earth metals that power many of not only our devices, but then these data centers. And just like we so often see, these industrial data centers are frequently placed in communities that are historically marginalized. They're often placed in communities of color. And there is literal environmental pollution. There is noise pollution. And I think, you know, this piece really explores this impact in a way that I think most folks don't think about, right? Because we just think, oh yeah, you know, I've posted this into the cloud. It's safe. It just lives literally in the cloud. But there's physical infrastructure here that has an environmental toll. And I really appreciate the way that this piece explored that. And Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, who wrote the piece, actually drafted this piece and then took a bunch of the research he worked for with us to go speak at the UN about this exact issue. So it's really an example of, yes, being kind of on the cutting edge and really being a part of conversations that are happening at a global level as we start to interrogate our impact and what our data does in the world, because it doesn't just exist in the ether.
And there isn't just a digital connectivity that we tackle, but real life connectivity as well. So, so important, because we are ultimately human beings. We need to sit face to face with one another. And so I loved the story that that you brought to this issue, Safe Sacred Spaces. Tell me about this. As an atheist, I loved this story.
I love hearing that. Safe Sacred Spaces is about, it's by Sarah Youngblood Gregory, one of our contributors who covers LGBTQ rights for Yes. And it's a beautiful piece about the ways that LGBTQ people are creating faith spaces where their identity is a blessing, not a sin, particularly within the Christian faith, right? There are many faith communities within the U.S. that said Christianity is the dominant religion in this country. And Christianity is also where most LGBTQ people have experienced religious harm. either from growing up in the church or seeking community in the church and being ostracized, being told who they love, who they are, is a sin. And she opens with a really interesting anecdote about some allegedly progressive moves from Pope Francis, who announced that transgender people can be baptized in the Catholic Church and that priests may bless individual same-sex unions. But the catch is, as long as those unions do not resemble marriage, which doesn't make sense to me, right? It's these, and both of those proclamations come with caveats that as long as those blessings, those baptisms, do not cause confusion among the faithful, right? So Sarah has this line that just sticks with me, where she talks about how LGBTQ people have for too long been expected to be grateful for scraps of food of a well-fed faith at a table. And I think it's just a powerful visual about what LGBTQ people are so often expected to accept within their faith communities, right? Where we accept this, love the sinner, hate the sin. But if the alleged sin is a central part of who you are, how much can you love an individual? So this piece is really kind of classic solutions journalism from Yes. It looks at the ways that different folks across the country are carving out faith communities, right? They did not find affirming spaces in their own communities, in their own religious traditions, their own religious denominations. So they're creating their own, and they are finding beauty and healing and community and connection. Because for so many people who were raised in faith communities, that connection is really central, not only to a higher power, but to other folks who share those beliefs. And for many LGBTQ people who have experienced religious harm and ostracization, they lose that connection, but they're often still seeking it. So it's a beautiful piece looking at ways that grassroots organizers are creating those spaces in real time, are carving out churches, centers, for LGBTQ people and anyone who has felt othered by their faith tradition to come and find a home, find a spiritual home that affirms them and accepts them and tells them that there's nothing wrong with who they are. And I think it's a really beautiful piece.
Well, there's so much to discuss. I encourage our viewers and listeners to pick up a copy at your local newsstand or subscribe to get a hold of the magazine and go through, you know, so many more stories that we didn't even get to in detail. But let's wrap up our conversation, Sanavi, with a mention of the art that goes into making these magazines. So visually beautiful. We think of the physical magazine these days as kind of a dinosaur, a dying breed of, you know, news sharing. But there's something so beautiful about holding sort of a mini book in one's hand that's very visually appealing. And we've got some talented people at ES who put it together. So even the cover itself is quite stunning, right?
The cover is stunning, and the cover is a photograph by Andreas Varro from his series on surreal photography. It's this incredible image, and I really have to give so much credit to our art director, Natalie Pryor, who continues to knock it out of the park. We bring her broad, kind of esoteric themes that I, as a print journalist, as a writer, I have no idea how to represent any of this visually. I can write the foundational documents that explore how we're going to, you know, how we're going to approach this issue, but I don't have any idea how to represent it visually. And Natalie continues to find photographs and artists who not only do the theme justice, but really are provocative and thought-provoking in their representation. And I think that's very true of this cover, where we see this, you know, a woman holding up her phone, taking a selfie. She's surrounded by these kind of just disembodied thumbs up at the bottom. And then we see in her arm, there's a crying child. And it just speaks so much to this, I think, moment where we want to present our beautiful, you know, best angled selves online to get all of these likes, all these thumbs ups, without really acknowledging the reality of what's happening around us, of the complexity, the difficulties that we might be facing. And I think, you know, the ways that impacts the people around us, right? We present these idealized versions of ourselves online so often, and that leads other folks who are struggling, maybe in the same ways we are, to think that they are alone. And it contributes to that isolation that then we posit in this issue, connection can be a cure for.
Sanavi, thank you so much. And people can subscribe, as I mentioned, to Yes Magazine. You can ask your local newsstands to carry it. And we also do have a digital version for those who just prefer that. And that's at yesmagazine.org. Thank you again, Sanavi.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
Sanavi Bridenham is managing editor at Yes Media. And I'm Sonali Kulhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and also host of this program, Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this show at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.